evening. It is Tuesday, March 24th, 2020, and it is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. As COVID-19 continues to spread across America's bipartisan political landscape, will the country be able to save itself? With a global pandemic testing the country's political, financial, social, and moral fabric, there are growing signs that answering in the affirmative has become increasingly more difficult. For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He's a co-founder of Black Alliance for Peace, former vice presidential nominee for the Green Party, and he has a new op-ed entitled Coronavirus, Militarism, and the End of an Illusion, Ajamu Baraka. As always, Ajamu, welcome back.
My pleasure.
So the World Health Organization said today that the United States could become the global epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic, which finally forced reluctant organizers to postpone the Tokyo 2020 Summer Olympics. In Geneva, WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris told reporters that there'd been a very large acceleration in infections in the United States. Over the previous 24 hours, 85% of the new cases were in Europe and the U.S., and of those, 40% were in the U.S. Your thoughts, sir?
That we are facing a very serious situation in the U.S. That requires unusual responses. But what we have been seeing from the Trump administration and from most of the business leaders over the last few days is a real reluctance to acknowledge the seriousness of the situation in that country. The real possibility of thousands losing their lives because they are more concerned with the viability of the economy than the value of human life. In fact, that's been part of the problem. That here we see the U.S. not even experiencing the spike in cases. While the Trump administration and others are discussing the possibility of loosening the very loose procedures they put in place to deal with this this pandemic, so it's really exposing the hegemony of a value system in the U.S. that places profits over the people, and this is something that is becoming quite apparent to more and more people in the U.S.
But, Ajamu, the president told us a couple of weeks ago, we only have 12 cases. They're just going to magically disappear. I don't understand what all of the consternation and hand-wringing is about. They're just going to disappear. People can go back to work, cure themselves, and why is this a problem?
Well, I mean, yeah, and of course, at that point, too, there was like 15 cases in the country. And now we see that we're now in the tens of thousands, and it seems to be doubling every day or two. So, you know, this is a situation that cannot be resolved through wishful thinking. It requires a real dramatic response from the state. But part of the issue, Dr. Leon, is that the Trump administration and indeed most of the leaders have been reluctant to exercise the full power of the state because of their ideological commitment to the notion that it is the private sector that should be the lead on any of these kinds of social challenges. They don't want to legitimize a larger role for the state, even if it means saving human lives, because of that concern that would legitimize in the imagination of the public a bigger, greater and more effective role of the state in the economy. So we are, so people's lives are being sacrificed for a commitment to a capitalist ideology.
Bureaucratic missteps have led to a shortfall in tests needed to determine the true scope of the virus. Hospitals are pleading for more medical equipment as doctors resort to using homemade masks. Financial markets have lost a third of their value in less than a month. Reveling spring breakers have hit the beaches in defiance of a nationwide social distance campaign. In terms of the bureaucratic missteps, to your point, there really seems to be an issue with the administration using its power as the national government over the state government and understanding that the two must work in concert. But in terms of overall direction, overall leadership and focus, in my opinion, that message should be coming very clearly, very consistently from the bully pulpit that is called the White House. And unfortunately, what we seem to get is a public health expert such as Anthony Fauci standing at a podium giving one message, being immediately followed by the president and the vice president that give a different message.
Well, you know, Dr. Lamb, that's why to characterize the moves that were made at the beginning of this pandemic in the U.S. As bureaucratic missteps, I think it doesn't really capture what really happened. I would say that less missteps than calculated political decision making that was. Very reluctant to acknowledge the seriousness of the situation in the U.S. And as a consequence of politicizing the situation in that way, they put into place the inevitable results that we're seeing today. Again, this is an example of the hegemony of ideology over common sense.
How so? Explain what you mean by that, please. The hegemony of political ideology.
The commitment that the private sector should be the leading sector in these kinds of situations. The capitalism and the for-profit health system should be seen as the system or the best system in place to handle anything that might emerge in the society. And to be reluctant to exercise the full power of the state because of what that might mean in terms of legitimizing the role of the state. And so what we have as a consequence, when you push the hegemony of the private sector, when you keep the government, both national and state governments, dependent on the private sector, then what you put in place is a situation where government has to go to the private sector hat in hand, begging the private sector to respond to this social need, this societal wide need that we have for more medical supplies and more medical equipment, as opposed to the national government exercising its power to, in essence, do what Governor Cuomo called for it from New York to nationalize the medical supply companies to make sure that supplies were, in fact, made available and distributed to those parts of the country that most needed them. So because of this commitment to capitalist ideology, those common sense measures were not followed. And the result is what we are seeing today, with people unnecessarily losing their lives because of this commitment to capitalist ideology.
The president is indicating that he may soon push businesses to reopen, defying the advice of COVID-19 experts. Trump, under growing pressure, to rescue an economy in free fall said yesterday that he may soon loosen federal guidelines for social distancing and encourage shuttered businesses to reopen. This at the very time when governors such as Larry Hogan in Maryland are shutting down all businesses in the state. You have the governor in Virginia closing all schools. You have the governor in New York taking very, very similar measures. So once again, we are now seeing play itself out again, a federal articulation of a strategy that is directly inconsistent with Gavin Newsom in California.
You know, Dr. Leon, it's important for us to remind the listeners that, yes, this possibility exists, but it's not just the Trump administration and Trump himself as a person. But we have seen these messages emerging that it was important to begin to reassess these social distancing requirements and to begin to move toward opening the economy back up, coming from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, various individuals connected to Goldman Sachs. It's been quite clear that the ruling class, the capitalist business interests, are very much rattled by what has occurred, and they have made and are making calculated decisions, cold-blooded cost-benefit decisions that suggest they are willing to trade off losing human life in order to try to prop up the overall capitalist economy. So this is a class issue as opposed to an evil kind of Trump sort of construction, and that's important to point out, because what we have at this moment is a teachable moment for the public, for people to understand and what they are seeing. And what they are in fact seeing is an exposure on the part of the capitalist class of its particular class interests and interests that are contrary to the interests of the general public. And that's important for us to understand and come to terms with, because the politics in the U.S. after this this crisis will never be the same again. And so we have to frame these things in a way that helps people to understand what must be done in this society if we're going to be able to save ourselves in the short term and in the long term.
Elaborate a little further, please, in the context of your piece, Coronavirus, Militarism, and the End of an Illusion.
So basically, what we have seen with the virus is not only the fragility of the capitalist economy, but the fact that the public health service or public health system in the U.S. Is non-existent. And because of that, and because of the other contradictions of U.S. Standing in the world, the notion of the U.S. is as some kind of exceptional nation, the shining hill, the shining city on the hill, all of this now is being completely exposed for the fairy tale that has always been, that the illusion of the U.S. being a global leader has now been completely exploded. So this is one of the positive things that will emerge from this crisis, the fact that we can now begin to penetrate some of the mythology that keeps people connected to this state and to this system, where because now it's quite obvious to more and more people that the system and the capitalist class are unable to address the human rights and human rights needs of the vast majority of the people.
I did not ask you to prepare for this next question, but I know you are prepared for this next question. Looking at the United States increasing sanctions on Venezuela, increasing sanctions on Iran and other countries in the midst of this COVID-19 crisis as cases in those countries continue to rise. This being used, or these sanctions and this virus being used as a method of increased pressure. Even though the United States did not introduce the contagion into those countries, I am of the opinion that using the contagion as added pressure is akin to germ warfare. Your thoughts?
It's quite clear for many of us that strengthening the sanctions in the midst of this global pandemic is not only illegal, it is immoral. And that nations should use the tool of universal jurisdiction to indict and arrest leaders of the U.S. Once this pandemic is past us. That it is no justification for this. This is genocide, and it's irrational in the sense that as long as you have populations unable to fight this virus, there's always the possibility that that virus is going to remain circulating. It's in the objective interest of everyone to exercise a new kind of internationalism to fight this global pandemic. That's why it's a pandemic. But to politicize this in that way is not only illegal, it is irrational, and I'm hoping that more and more people in the U.S. will begin to speak out against this irrational and immoral posture on the part of their government.
In fact, the action that the United States is taking in terms of ratcheting up sanctions, forcing, for example, Venezuela to pay three times as much for medical supplies as they would have to pay otherwise, if your objective is truly to overturn the government, having the people of your target country see you as a friend, I believe would go a lot further in terms of the use of soft power, would go a lot further in terms of ingratiating yourselves to those people and getting those people to see your way, as opposed to inflicting more suffering upon those people, where all you're really doing then is heightening the sense of nationalism and strengthening the hand of those in power.
I think you're right, Dr. Leon, but it reflects, the kind of irrational policy making that we see coming from the U.S. authorities really reflects the pathology of white supremacists, the white supremacist mentality. Because you're correct, if they were really intent on a rational policy that would win some people over, they would be moving in a different way. But they're more intent on inflicting collective punishment on the people of Venezuela and Iran and others. And so in some ways, their policies become counterproductive, because what they really want is, in their imagination, they want complete and total surrender of those nations. But those people, once they have tasted freedom for a while, they're not going to give that up. And so what we're going to see as a consequence of these policies is continued suffering in those nations. But what we have to keep on coming back to, Dr. Leon, is the fact that more and more people who are becoming aware of these policies by their own government in places like Venezuela and Iran, when they don't speak out against those policies, then they become also collaborators. And they are then morally complicit in the criminality of this state. So we've got to make that reality also quite apparent to people, that there's no hiding from this. Either you are standing on the side of human rights and morality, or you're standing on the side of reaction, racism, and irrationality.
Brother Ajamu Baraka, thank you as always for your time. Greatly appreciate your insight and look forward to having you back.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Top lawmakers and the Trump administration closed in on completing a colossal stimulus package worth at least $1.6 trillion designed to shield the U.S. economy from the most drastic consequences of the coronavirus pandemic. Negotiators reconvened this morning with some lawmakers predicting that the two sides were hours away from securing a final agreement. Well, America is waiting, and the Senate could move quickly to vote on the package later today, if not this evening, if an agreement is reached. All of this while Senate Democrats applauded for again stopping GOP corporate bailout that leaves Americans behind. For the second time in less than 24 hours, a largely united Senate Democratic caucus yesterday stopped Republicans from advancing a nearly $2 trillion coronavirus package that progressives have characterized as a massive bailout for corporate America that leaves ordinary people out to dry. That basically is the crux of the conflict between Schumer and the White House. Well, what's really going on here? For insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California and is the author of the new book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. And his latest op-ed is entitled, The New Federal Reserve as Garbage Can for All Capitalist Debt, Dr. Jack Rasmus. As always, Jack, welcome back.
Glad to join you again.
So, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said this morning that he expected a deal. He and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer completed a round of late-night talks last night, predicting that they could soon finalize an agreement, which Schumer said could run to $2 trillion. Are there points of contention really going on, are there points of contention really going to make a difference in the lives of average Americans, or have a greater impact on the bottom line for business interests?
Well, you know, first of all, you got to realize this so-called $2 trillion is not really $2 trillion in actual spending. It's about two-thirds of that. And then the assumption, according to advisor Larry Kudlow, of a multiplier effect of 1.5 or 1.5. I don't think the multiplier is going to be that big. And you won't get $2 trillion out of the $1.3 trillion actual spending. $1.3 trillion is just not enough. It will get you through 1 month. But if this thing is going to go on longer than 1 month here, which looks likely, unless Trump, of course, says go back to work here and money's more important, the economy's more important than grandma and grandpa, unless that happens, this is just a stopgap. You know, $1.3 trillion or $1 trillion, whatever it is, we'll see later today, is just get you through 1 month here.
Let me stop you there and ask you, is that intentional by the administration? Is that to you an indication that the president is really planning to try to send the country back to work in order to protect himself at the ballot box instead of offering a full-blown solution to this problem?
Well, yes, I think, and it's not just Trump. You know, he's getting a lot of pressure from business interests to reopen the economy. So it's Trump and certain business interests, not all of them, but certain ones, are willing to trade off certain number of deaths, because the death rate will certainly increase if everyone goes back to work. And not everyone is not working. You know, it's mostly 15-20 states where we have shelter in place going on. But yes, he definitely, I think, now has decided he wants to start pushing the country back to work prematurely, because it will raise the curve and the death rate. And
because money is more important to some folks than lives of other people. And that's why you see a kind of a short-term package here. This is not a long-term package. This is short-term. It's heavily weighted towards loans and grants towards big businesses. Let's take the airline industry, for example, right? The airline industry under this proposal is going to get $32 billion in immediate grants. That's free money. And another $29 billion in loans. That's $61 billion the airline's going to get. And consider this. The airline industry in recent years gave its shareholders and its CEOs $45 billion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. If they hadn't been so generous with themselves and their shareholders, they wouldn't need $60 billion, $32 billion just in grants, would they? Well, that's been repeated everywhere in a lot of industries. And now those industries want free money. In other words, grants, is not just loans, but grants. That's been the contention, one of the contention spots with the Democrats. First of all, they want some limits on these free grants because, what's it going to do? They're going to give themselves more stock buybacks and dividend payouts and senior manager bonuses. And that's been part of the contention with them. And the other is unemployment insurance, that Democrats want some increases in unemployment insurance levels and duration for households, because that's the big problem. You got a collapse going on of 20-30% in consumption. You've got some bank research departments like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley saying we're going to have a 25-30% drop in GDP here in the second quarter, not counting what's going on in March. 1-2 million people are going to be out of work. How are they going to support themselves? You need a massive increase here in the injection into the households. You need to increase unemployment insurance and guarantees. You need to pay all their medical costs somehow. And you need to give them a cash injection here to get over this first month. But if it's lasting more than a month, I've estimated they're going to need $4 trillion in stimulus for consumers and households. And, consider the fact that the Federal Reserve has already given banks and investors $6 trillion. They've lined up $6 trillion, and they said they'll give more if they have to. And the banks haven't even failed yet, unlike 2008, right? So we're pre-bailing out the banks with $6 trillion from the central bank, the Federal Reserve, and we're divvying out 2 weeks or so of support for households. I mean, what's going on here? And Trump wants to send us all back to work after 2 weeks so that the infection rate and the death rate escalates in the U.S. Well, it shows you what they really value. They value their money over the lives of American people.
So that takes me back to my question, the title of your piece, The New Federal Reserve as Garbage Can for All Capitalist Debt. At the end of the day, when Schumer and Mnuchin are done negotiating, are they really negotiating for the best interest of the average person, or are they negotiating for the best interest of the bankers and the finance class?
Well, what's going on in the Federal Reserve is the bankers and the finance class and the investors and so forth behind the scenes. Well, not if it's all public, $6 trillion we're throwing at those people. Just as we did in 2008-09, we threw $4 trillion at them. Now we're throwing $6 trillion at them. That's the pre-bailout of the financial investor side of the economy. What's going on in Congress is about, what about Main Street? How do we deal with Main Street and non-financial corporations? How do we bail them out? And you got this big battle going with McConnell and Trump wanting to give, again, $500 billion or more in free money, pretty much, to big businesses, not small businesses, That's mm-hmm. where the grants should be given to small businesses. People with companies with under 100 employees should be getting the grants, not these big corporations like the airlines who are sitting on fat, slush funds anyway, you know, and giving themselves the trillions of the Fortune 500 companies in the last 3 years in this country have given themselves buybacks and dividend payouts. $3.4 trillion under Trump. $3.4 trillion they distributed to shareholders and senior managers. And now they want another $500 billion? No, this is big business, you know, and then there's small business, and then there's households. That's what's involved in this bill in Congress and how it met $1.3 trillion or whatever. It gets divvied up among those three sections. And who's losing out? Really, are even the Democrats are fighting for it best they can in the Senate, controlled by McConnell, of course, and the Republicans. The households and workers are getting something, but it's the big businesses who gave themselves $3.4 trillion who are getting hundreds of billions of dollars in grants and loans.
And they're not going to use that money to rehire workers. They're not going to use that money to raise salaries. They're not going to use that money to, again, replace displaced people. That's not going to stimulate the economy.
Well, you know, how much are they going to hoard it and sit on it is the question. You know, that's what's called, the economists call that the liquidity preference. In other words, you give them money, they're going to sit on it. Not really going to loan it out if they're banks, because they're not sure of what the future is going to be. I mean, a good case is the airline industry, and they're part of $61 billion in this bill, right? $32 billion is a grant. Well, at least the Democrats were able to, in disagreement, it appears, force the airline industries to take that $32 billion and spend it only on workers' wages. You know, the airlines were threatening that they were going to lay everybody off within a couple months if they didn't get the $60 billion right. from Congress. You know, that was the threat. They were going to go on strike. Business airlines management was going to go on strike and lay everybody off. Lockout, as they call that, right? If they didn't get the $60 billion grant. Well, the compromise appears to be they're going to get $32 billion in grant, but that has to be spent on wages. Well, they're just going to pocket the other money they have on in their slush funds, you know, for themselves. And they're going to get $29 billion more in loans from the government, which will be forgiven at some stage, you know, later on down the road. But there, all these big corporations are playing this game in this fiscal stimulus bill. They're fattening up, their protected slush funds here and waiting to see what happens. And I don't think they're going to spend much or even most of it here. And the households are just going to get really two to three weeks worth of coverage here. That's why Trump wants to push everyone back to work, because he doesn't want to spend any more. We already had a $1.4 trillion deficit, budget deficit, going into this crisis. The deficit for this year will be over $2 trillion, maybe $3 trillion. Well, you know, with all the layoffs and the deficits and so forth, his election doesn't look as solid as it was maybe 3 months ago. And that's all he's thinking about.
We've been on this show for months talking about the looming or a pending downturn, a weakness in the economy. What I see in this pandemic is that this isn't causing the economic crisis. It's exacerbating a weakness that was on the horizon. I mean, we've been saying this on the show for 10 months, that a recession was on its way.
Yeah, well, this whole virus thing precipitated it and accelerated it. In right. other words, it was slowly sinking the global economy, and the U.S. economy was slowly slowing down, and eventually it was going to trip into a recession. I thought it would be here at the fourth quarter of 2019 or right after the election. But this whole thing changed the whole schedule, and it precipitated it and accelerated it. The decline is faster and deeper than it was in 1932. In other words, we are losing jobs at a higher rate, and the economy, measured in GDP, is contracting at a faster rate than the worst months during the Great Depression. And that means if it's going deeper and faster, the recovery is going to take longer. Don't think that even if this thing ended tomorrow, there would be a V-shaped recovery. No, business is wounded. Households, balance sheets are wounded, and people are going to be very cautious in terms of bringing hires back. They're going to find ways to cut costs, and they're going to carry the cost cutting into the future here. Business will. They won't hire people back as fast or as many or at as high a rate as they were paying them. They're going to be very careful about that. Households are going to be very careful because they've been wounded here about saving and not consuming and not spending. And that psychological attitude by business and households are going to lag and carry over for years. We saw that after the 2008-09 crash. You know, it took us 5 years just to get the level of jobs back that we had before the crash in 2008. It's going to take longer to get these jobs back now because the contraction is even more severe today than it was. So this thing is not going to end, even under the best of assumptions, immediately and quickly. It's going to drag out. We're going to know the legacy of this for years to come. And it's going to take a lot more stimulus. As I said, my program that I've laid out on my blog, jackrasmus.com, requires $4 trillion of stimulus to households, $4 trillion. The Federal Reserve will take care of the banks, you know, $6 trillion, maybe $8 trillion. They're prepared to spend already, right? Who's going to take care of the middle class, the working class of American households? Well, you know, they're willing to divvy up 2 weeks' worth, but it doesn't look like they're willing to address the rest of that if this thing drags on, which it's going to do.
You mentioned the legacy of this for years to come. There are those that are saying that our economy is not going to recover in the context of we have to get used to a new normal, that we're not going to get our economy back to where it was before this happened. Are you saying that yes, we can, it's just going to take a very long time, or that we are now going through an event that is going to bring about such a structural change that it's going to be a different economy?
More of the latter. I think it's going to be a while to come back, and that while will be longer if it's back to business as usual, or what they say, new normal. What that usually means is, you know, economists, new normal. They're really telling you, get ready to tighten your belts because it's going to be even worse than it was. That's the new normal. You see, that's the phrase for that. If they want to really recover this thing in a reasonable fashion, it's going to take structural changes in the economy. It's going to take, and that means it's going to take somehow we've got to focus on the incomes of the middle class and the working class of this country. And to do that, private sector won't do that. Private sector will look, multinational corporations will look for opportunities to take the money and spend it offshore, or they will take the money and spend it in a fast recovering stock and bond market. They won't necessarily spend it on the kind of investment we need that creates jobs for real people, creates real income, and boosts the real economy in this country. We're going to need some sort of emergency public investment corporation. We're going to have to stop dithering about paying $1.5 trillion to paper pusher health insurance companies and go to Medicare for All. And we're going to have to do something about the government stepping up and really boosting spending on alternative energy boosting spending in those areas of the economy that are growth areas of the economy. The government's going to have to continue to take a bigger role in the economy and the recovery. You know, when we went into World War II, the U.S. GDP, the government spending, was about 15% of GDP. In 1 year, 1942, the government was spending 40% of GDP. Now, that's a war mobilization. We are in a war against this virus. And if we're going to defeat it, the economy must mobilize on a war basis. But Trump is not going to do that.
Got you. Dr. Jack Rasmus, as always, thank you for your time. Appreciate your input and look forward to having you back.
Glad to join you whenever.
Thanks, Jack. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The U.S. vows to cut $1 billion in aid to Afghanistan as political crisis threatens peace deal. In a sign of mounting frustration with Afghanistan's leaders, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced earlier today that the United States would cut $1 billion in aid to the country because of its inability to form a unity government to negotiate with the Taliban. Well, what's going on here? Is Pompeo really just talking to himself? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's the director of Afghanistan and Pakistan Studies at the Middle East Institute. He is Dr. Marvin G. Weinbaum. Dr. Weinbaum, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Surely. Pleasure.
So, Secretary of State Pompeo said that Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and his main rival, Abdullah Abdullah, had failed to set aside their differences just hours after meeting with the two men in a quickly arranged visit to Kabul. Well, what is he expecting? Both men claim to be president. Both have held swearing-in ceremonies that were broadcast, simulcast on television. What was Pompeo expecting to be the result of his conversations with Ghani and Abdullah?
Well, he wanted to repeat what happened in 2014. When there was a similar showdown between the same two people. And at that time, Secretary of State Kerry was able to get them together and keep them at it. And when things looked like they were falling apart, he threatened that the U.S. would withdraw its assistance to Afghanistan. That certainly caught their attention, and they agreed to what became the unity government, which, as we know, didn't work very well. But at least at the time, it headed off what looked like it might even be an armed clash in the two sides. Again, I'm speaking of 2014.
But wasn't there also a slightly different power dynamic in play at the time, which made it easier, and I put easier in air quotes, for Kerry to bring those two parties together as opposed to what we're looking at now with the U.S. already removing troops from the area?
Well, that's a valid point. Our leverage, obviously, U.S. leverage becomes lessened, but money is still an issue. Now, we give more than $1 billion of non-military, but nevertheless, this has to be a pinch. And as I understand it, Pompeo said we could withdraw another million. No, I think that what really makes the difference is that we've had 5 years plus of what happened with this kind of arrangement between the two, arrangement, which was anything but.
Where do you really see the major sticking points between Ghani and Abdullah, other than both men want to be president?
One of the major sticking points here would be the very fact that the unity government didn't work. They could never really figure out what power sharing meant. To Ashraf Ghani, it meant very little. He made virtually nothing of the chief executive position. carried on pretty much as he would have as president. And if he felt comfortable doing that then, when he was newly elected, he certainly feels now that he is the legitimate president. The international community has recognized him. So he wants to give up as little as possible in any kind of arrangement. But it's the lack of trust between them that really is the sticking point here. Whatever agreement they reach, neither side really believes the other side is going to stick to what they've agreed to.
So with that being understood and the United States really trying to triangulate this issue, as in the Taliban, the Afghan government, and the United States, it really seems right now as though the Taliban would look upon this with the dysfunction on the Afghan side and figure that they have a great deal more power than their opponents.
They are certainly in a very advantageous position here, because all this is demonstrating is what they are claiming, and that is that there's not really a legitimate government in Kabul for them to negotiate with. And so that is showing these people can't even agree on who represents or who leads this government. And Pompeo seems to be talking more easily with the Taliban than he is with the Kabul government. He seems to have further elevated them here as the parties that really know what they want and want to conduct a dialogue. Because you see, as we know, a dialogue, and this is somewhat unprecedented, has taken place directly between Ghani government, and this is, I understand, a Skype discussion with the Taliban. Now, it's not over negotiating on peace or preparing for an intra-Afghan meeting. It's on the one thing that the Taliban wants at this point, and that is the prisoner release. And here, the U.S. actually sides with the Taliban. It is asking that the release be made. After all, the U.S. agreed to it in what was the accord between the U.S. and the Taliban some weeks ago. So right now, it looks, as I say, like the Taliban have more legitimacy with the U.S. than the government does. And the Taliban want that prisoner release for good reason, because they expect that this is going to put the government on its back foot. The government will effectively, for all that they made here about how they wanted something in exchange for it, may very well get nothing. And this is, as I say, a very disadvantageous position that the government finds itself on, and strangely, the U.S. seems to be on the other side.
Now, to that point that the United States seems to be on the other side, Pompeo said, quote, "The United States is disappointed in them and what their conduct means for Afghanistan and our shared interests. Their failure has harmed U.S.-Afghan relations." He's talking about the Afghan government. "And sadly, dishonors those Afghan Americans and coalition partners who have sacrificed their lives and treasure in the struggle to build a new future for this country," end quote. Is part of the problem here that there's not a clear understanding of what the meaning of shared interests really means?
Well, I think this is a very hurtful statement. It's saying because you people can't agree, then you're dishonoring everything we've done for you. That linkage, I find, very distasteful.
As did I.
I just think that, you know, the sacrifices, that's true enough, certainly. Certainly that is. But to say, because we won't agree with you on what you're proposing in the way of a settlement between us, that therefore this suggests that you have no respect for us and everything we've done for you. I'm amazed to hear that.
Well, I also think it's incredibly paternalistic, and I would even say that the Afghan government's response could be, and I'm not saying should be, but could be, look, we didn't ask you to come in here in the first place. You all came in here as the imperial global hegemon that you are, and so what are you talking about shared interest?
No, well, wait a second. I think now you're mixing two things because the U.S. Did come in with initially, if we go back to 2001, the overwhelming approval of the Afghans, who in the long run have not been able to establish the kind of states that both the U.S. and the Afghan government or the leaders at the time would have wanted. But I wouldn't tie this into any larger global issue here. What we have here is that there's a very close relationship necessarily all these years. And now I think that that's put in jeopardy by this kind of action and rhetoric. Now, we could argue separately whether U.S. motives are what they were at the time. We go back to 2001. This was simply retribution for what had taken place and an effort to eliminate what was considered to be a regime which was providing protection to the U.S.'s determined major adversary in Osama bin Laden. So I think we ought to put that kind of argument aside.
Well, let me ask you this, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Not only U.S. interests at the time, but my point was really more how independent was the Afghan government at that time from U.S. interest so that it would have been able to push back against the U.S. and say, no, you're not coming in. If the Afghan government had decided they did not want this war fought on their territory, would they have been able to keep the U.S. out?
No, but you're saying there wouldn't have been a government if the U.S. hadn't come in.
That was my very narrow point, is that they couldn't have kept us out. That was my point.
Yeah, but remember that when in Bonn in 2001 they met, this was an international meeting. And this was a meeting in which this government was shaped not just by the United States and Karzai was made president, but by all of the countries in the region, including Iran and Russia and Pakistan, all played a major role in getting the various sides together and to form a government at that time. So this was an international effort because now the U.S., you can go back a step and say, well, the U.S. should found some other way to get rid of them. Well, remember that the U.S. at the time, and I was in a position to know this, the U.S. at the time gave the Taliban a way out. There didn't have to be regime change. We were very explicit in saying, turn over bin Laden, and that's all we want. For whatever reason or reasons, the Taliban decided not to. They didn't yield on that, and that has been the Taliban's modus operandi all along. It never yields. I don't know any time when it has made any grand concessions, and that comes right up through the recent accords as well. It's always been in these negotiations, the U.S. and the government, which has yielded, partly because the Taliban, well, in this case, the U.S.'s desperation to get out, and the Taliban's determination that if it hangs in long enough, and it's always been their thought, if you hang in long enough, you'll prevail.
Following these most recent discussions, Pompeo went back to Qatar and met with the Taliban's chief negotiator. He then tells reporters that the Trump administration's principal concern right now is the Afghan leadership, not the Taliban. Is that really a good tactic in a way of making friends and influencing people in Afghanistan?
Well, it only reinforces what I've been saying all along here, that in all of this, what has happened is he's put himself on the side of the Taliban. And if he thinks that he is going to make it, therefore, easier for this government to survive, I think he's wrong. This undermines confidence now in the Ghani government, which the U.S. has come to recognize. And in cozying up to the Taliban with words like that, I don't see what he hopes to accomplish, except maybe ultimately to get the government to cave in, but with resentments which, given the rhetoric that's being used here, are going to be long around.
Dr. Marvin G. Weinbaum, thank you so much for your time. I know your time today is incredibly limited, and really appreciate your time. And as always, look forward to having you back.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you. All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.